it's just going to run for the duration.
Yeah, that's
so right. I'll come in and stop it at the end.
I'm sure we're still going to take the same time slots in terms of we're getting back in there for, well, we're going to run about
4:15, yeah. I will come maybe 5 minutes more. Right?
Lovely.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Skip off quickly then to the skills employment board's taking place in the run up to Tongwin Life. Yeah, that's too bad.
No, that's
but,
okay.
But
yeah.
I did say I'd be late. So.
What time are you going?
I'm here for the duration, but it's just hanging out. Yeah, I wouldn't be able to go back in. No, don't worry. No. They know I'm being late, so.
Yeah, are we ready? Are we okay to start? Good stuff. Okay. Pnawn da chi gyd. Good afternoon to you all. Croeso chi gyd yma i'r sesiwn y pnawn yma. Welcome to this afternoon's session. The theme of which is building the plan. Now, I'm Ed Evans from Civil Engineering Contractors Association, so you can probably guess that building the plan is quite close to my heart. It's a pretty broad topic, but we're going to focus in this afternoon on the supply chain issues and the supply chain that we need to build whatever that plan is. And it stems from this morning, so we've got a little bit of a way to get there in the first place. But we're going to have, there's three bits to this afternoon. So we're going to look at how we engage with the supply chain, how we facilitate the involvement of the supply chain in some of the larger projects, and how we then make sure that that supply chain has got the right skills as we move forward into the future. And we've got an illustrious panel here this afternoon to take us to support us through this. We've got Ben, Terry and Steve, which I know sounds like a boy band from the 60s.
Looking at their 40s.
The biographies are attached in the pack, so I'm not going to run through those. But to my left is Ben Cotton. Ben is Head of External Affairs at the FSB, that's the Federation of Small Businesses. If you're struggling to find him on the list, he's the guy who looks about 12 years old.
It was 11 years ago, that picture. That's quite nice.
13. Yeah. Then we've got Steve Lawrence, who's a director with Mott MacDonald. Steve's a fellow civil engineer. We always tend to meet at these events, which probably means we need to get a life
probably,
Steve.
Yeah.
And then at the far end is Terry Fitzgibbon of Construction Elite International. We met last week, Terry, for the first time.
We did, indeed.
I think, a really very impressive CV until I found out that he was a quantity surveyor, but you can't have it all, I guess.
There we go, I'll leave now.
So the format for this afternoon is those three topics. I'm going to spend about 10 minutes on each. And I'm going to throw a few questions into the panel just to get some of the discussion going. And then hopefully we'll have about 10, 15 minutes for an open discussion across the floor. So hopefully that's okay for you. I'm going to start with the P word, which we touched on this morning, which is procurement. Public sector procurement in particular. Because I think it's a bit of a theme through all these topics, these things that we're going to cover this afternoon. And really, why is it so difficult? Why is it so bureaucratic at times, costly, etc.? And really, does it have to be this way? Because I think it impacts on those three things, and is there a better way? So, we'll get straight into this. What I'm going to do, I'm going to just direct a few questions at individuals and then bring the others in as well. So I'm going to start with you first of all, Ben. Now, you're not from an infrastructure background.
No,
the rest of us on this panel, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah, I bring balance to the force.
You're obviously, through your role with the FSB, you are in touch with businesses, and that's what we're talking about here in terms of supply chain, different businesses. So I'd like to get your views, really, in terms of how I'll call it the industry, but the sector as a whole, how it can engage better with the supply chain, large and small, not forgetting that we sometimes think that we haven't got any big businesses in Wales. Actually, we've got some big deliverers in Wales, as well as some of the smaller guys. So do you want to share some thoughts on that?
Yeah, in terms of engagement, I I'd say, first of all, there is a problem in Wales in the way we organise ourselves as networks. And so it's an intelligence as to the skill sets and capabilities that are out there. And I think that's not to say that the businesses required to deliver some of these infrastructure improvements aren't there, but I'm not sure we're networked well enough to provide that. So that's one of the questions, is about how well we develop our networks to be able to deliver against a vision. Now, you know, we are inherently a nation of small businesses. But when I talk about the importance from FSB's perspective of capitalising indigenous businesses, I do mean large and small. But I believe that, you know, there is a need to look at infrastructure investment in the same way as we would say we need to look at inward investment, that its value is beyond the project itself. It is about the way in which we use infrastructure spend and infrastructure projects to capitalise supply chain, grow businesses and grow competence within businesses. And of course, there are so obvious social benefits to that, not least also the development of the skills agenda and the skills capability. So that conversation about pipeline from our perspective is very important. We need a pipeline. We need to know what is coming to be able to organise ourselves to engage smaller businesses in this conversation. I clearly mentioned procurement. It is a perennial problem and continues to be problematic for the smallest businesses. To their credit, Welsh Government over the past few years do seem that they are listening to some of these conversations, but it is far from ideal. We still have bundling of contracts. You know, we still have the non-visibility of contracts, you know, over a value or up to a value. And I think the problem is, without that visibility, we can't have that conversation of where the competence is to deliver those projects within the supply chain, within the competence of businesses in Wales. So yes, we have come some way, but there is a long way to travel. And I think the problem with procurement is that it tends to be that the businesses, particularly the smallest businesses, where internal competence is limited and time to devote to engaging in those supply chains and procurement opportunity can be limited. It tends to be you have one bad experience and then you back away from it. I guess the other perspective from my point of view, and it is about the way in which we connect businesses, is the understanding of larger organisations, of the competency in smaller businesses around them. I think that needs to be better developed. Larger and smaller organisations are often obviously partners in the development of this. Now, I'm not going to suggest that the likes of Tidal Lagoon, you know, is going to be delivered, should it be delivered, and let's hope it's delivered, by an army of small businesses, as much as my members, you know, might like that to be the case. But it needs a partnership of those businesses of scale with a technical and strategic competence to be able to engage a localised supply chain. And so it comes back to this point about how do we use projects as an economic development benefit over and above the intrinsic value of the project itself.
Okay. I'll bring you guys in again. I think that whole thing about is procurement, or is the way we engage with, is should we be thinking at this from a point of view of building businesses in Wales, or is it just about the project itself? I'll bring in Terry first of all. Just some thoughts from your point of view, engaging with that supply chain. You know, how important is it that we see investment in a project as a way of growing businesses as well?
I think it's absolutely fundamental. We are the country that we are, and we're not going to change that however much we might wish. And therefore, the ability to forge relationships between the large, the medium and the small is absolutely fundamental to our prospects going forward. I should say that if anyone reads my sort of biography in the pack, one of the major things I do is I work for Transport for London, and I'm an advisor to the Mayor of London and the Secretary of State for Transport in relation to Transport for London's capital infrastructure programme. And one of the roles I have there is to bring economy and efficiency to their capital expend. And this idea of how we address their supply chain to maximise benefits has been very crucial to driving additional value, because lots of those small guys can fill the niches that the very big companies, so if we're dealing with sort of signalling, we'll have a big company like Alstom, Bombardier, whatever. We want to know what are their resources, not as an international company, because to use another name, Thales, a lot of their software product is developed in Canada, but it's going to be delivered in London by local suppliers, local installers. So we want to see the interplay between the large and the small, and we positively promote it. We are one of the things that I would otherwise address is our supply chain events that we put on, and we're looking very much for you, Thales, have an international business, but we have, it may be London, but in that context it's a relatively small business. How are we going to build those two things together? And I think using the small, the medium, to supplement the large is crucial to us.
Okay. Steve, do you want to, because you've obviously experienced, again, beyond Wales.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned we go to a lot of these events, and it seems a no-brainer, doesn't it, that we need to use the Welsh pound to generate Welsh benefit. But why doesn't it happen? And I think sometimes we make it quite difficult for ourselves, and we really need to be looking at the way that we're procuring these projects rather than just having an aspiration to engage with the local community and bring their community benefits. There needs to be a slicker approach, because often when I am involved with these projects, for day one we're all very, very aspirational. But once you get down into the mud and bullets of the project, things start to slip, and sometimes it's a lot easier than to go to a big UK national, easier to deliver, and they've got all the products, so we'll just go down that route. Hopefully they'll pick up the local supply chain in their supply chain, and you're almost moving the risk along because there isn't that approach from day one within the Welsh community to be able to make that happen easily and effectively. So it's something that we need as a body of people to put into place until we say, right, yeah, it is a no-brainer. How are we actually going to do it?
I think a lot of that comes from the employer side, so public bodies, looking at their procurement rules, what they're looking for, how they are marking the companies that are providing the bids, to ensure that the Welsh pound is staying in Wales, or alternatively, as you know, with public-driven procurement, that the larger projects which exist on our doorstep, Wales is seen to go out to get those projects.
Yeah,
you know, Hinkley is obviously the biggest construction project in the UK at the moment. There is a huge amount of money being spent just across the water. It's not only, I think, that we sometimes feel as a country that, you know, we are the recipient of the means by which other people do things, but we've got to be energetic enough and willing to go out and get what we want. And, you know, that's a classic example. You know, I've been down to Hinkley several times, engaging with the supply chain down there, and I haven't met too many Welsh businesses, I have to say.
Right, that's surprising and disappointing, I must admit. But Ben,
just on that point about Hinkley, I mean, that's a great example. So, notwithstanding the need for political sign-off, for some time that project had been coming. We didn't have the lead time to create the supply chain that delivers against a project that size is significant. And we didn't have an effective conversation here in Wales about the skills and competencies that would allow Welsh businesses to bid for that. And I'd say the same was the case for the Olympics in 2012. You know, the proportion of Welsh businesses that actually got contracts from the Olympic Games was very, very small by comparison to Northern Ireland businesses, for instance. And I think there is a need for us to create a better collaborative effort and you know, with a longer lead time in mind, to say, what do we need, how do we need to be fit to play, you know, how can we get to the point where we can bid to that, to a contract of that size. And that's, it doesn't matter whether you're the Arabs of this world or whether you're, you know, a two-man specialist operation. I think it's having the intelligence, you know, the sort of the intelligence of what's coming, but also being able to draw in all the competencies, whether it be FE to deliver some of the vocational skills that we desperately need to be able to deliver against these, or whether actually it is organisations like FSB collaborating with SECA or CBI or anyone else. I think we aren't as smart as we think we are, maybe. And I made the point earlier, I alluded to this notion of we think we're very, very closely networked, and that creates a complacency. I would argue we're not closely networked. I would argue that complacency of Wales being small actually is getting in our way, and I think we need to do a little bit more graft in making that pay for us more effectively.
I think that's a good point. Actually, we've probably covered just about all those topics in one area. So I'm going to go back into some of them. But can I just go back to you, Terry, in terms of your work with Transport for London? Do they actively see themselves as a promoter of opportunities for businesses in those areas, or is it something that is a byproduct?
That is very strongly driven by the mayor's directives. So Sadiq Khan, London businesses, growth within London is something he is taking a far greater interest in than the previous mayor. So it is something that has changed over time, but is very much at the forefront now.
Mm. Okay. We'll come back to this one, I think. I just want to keep the debate moving on. And if you've got any questions on this, can you hold them until we've gone through? Because I think we'll cover a lot of these things. But I knew you were going to ask something, because we've used the P word so many times. If you can hang on for a minute of this, and then we'll come back to some. Sticking with you, Terry, because you've got lots of experience of delivering infrastructure projects all over, really. Moving on to the facilitation, I suppose. What can we do to facilitate the involvement of supply chains and pulling them together, really? We're quite transactional, I think, traditionally transactional in the way we deal with this thing. You know, the way we do things, the way we pass risk down that supply chain, because we don't want it anywhere near us, and if I can keep passing it down, that's great. How would you see is the best way to facilitate real engagement and real involvement by supply chain through roads?
I think one of the things that the group that I am a part of within Transport for London, we have introduced very strong project sponsorship requirements. So you need someone leading from the front who knows what they want, when they need it by. Once you know what it is you want, then you have to identify those who can provide it. We often then will have supplier engagement days, which are broadly advertised. Anyone can come along, whether you're the largest, the smallest, the likes of, you know, Mark McDonald clearly would attend those type of events. It is the opportunity for the business to know about those who are interested in its business, and for those who are in business to make us aware of what it is that they can do. So we are very, very strong on supplier engagement. It has become even more important now. We are now subject to much more stringent financial constraints than we once were, and therefore we are looking at alternative procurement methods in terms of, for example, early contractor engagement. The event that you came along to the other day, I mentioned that we're doing a new station at Camden Town. We had a fully a developed design. Fully is not right. We had a developed design. Brought the contractors in, who've curtailed the program by a long time, and the station box, the bit that you know you pass through on your way to the train, is now much smaller than it would otherwise have been. So we're going to get a much more efficient product as a result of engaging earlier with the supply chain. That buildability, get it in early, and I think these are the sort of things that your members, on a broader context, can bring added value in relation to it. It doesn't have to be, you know, a very large organisation such as MOTS to take on a piece of work such as that. But we benefit hugely from having access, early access, to those specialist skills, because at the end of the day our real interest is delivering train services on time, not on building things. We do have to have an expertise in doing so, because we spend many billions of pounds a year, but nevertheless the opportunity to access that. So we look for our supply chain events so that we become aware. And I think what you said, Ben, in terms of complacency, I actually think it's something slightly different than that. It's a lack of ambition from some of our companies in terms of their willingness to go out and say, here is something that I have, a product that I can deliver to you and you will benefit from. You know, certainly I don't see Welsh companies doing that. The other thing which becomes ever more prevalent now, long-term relationships. If we we're just in the course of providing a new signalling system to what we call Deep Tube, which is the Central Line, Piccadilly Line, Bakerloo Line, Waterloo and City. We're going to have a 40-year relationship with a contractor, so we better get it right. Those long terms, that what is the whole life cost? So those transactional costs that you're looking at, we're looking at, we've got an asset here which must last 125 years. We will have a 40-year relationship between, there's a refresh in terms of trains and, you know, related telecoms and that type of system. So having people involved in long-term relationships with us is very important. Yes. But I'm not quite sure that translates to here, where, you know, the one-off quick win tends to be more prevalent. And I think it is for those who sponsor major projects, back to this pipeline idea, to be looking forward.
Yeah.
Who can we partner with? Who can we forge relationships with? Not for today, not for tomorrow, but for the next 5, 10, 15 years, because it is over those periods we will be delivering this pipeline.
So maybe there's an issue about redefining that public-private relationship as well.
I think so.
You might not have a 40-year agreement if Jeremy Corbyn gets elected. You never know, you never know.
I suspect not.
Steve, do you want to just add to that? Because you obviously experiences from that public private
interface. Yeah, I mean, we're sitting in a private consultancy, and we're acutely aware of things. You know, we've touched in the past about project bank accounts, for instance, and it's very transactional, our business, and it is the bottom of the supply chain that actually are paid last. So if we can make sure there's some surety on payment, we will get a lot more confidence, and the confidence is what's required.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think from the public side, they need to be a little bit more confident in actually going out to market. They can go out maybe a little bit quicker, a little bit looser, to allow innovation to come into the project. So rather than having the designers designed to quite a high level, actually go out with a specification and a description and say, you know, there you are, Mr. Marketplace, what would you like to deliver that particular product? And it might actually engender a bit of confidence within the marketplace that they've got an opportunity here. So I think there's both sides of the confidence stakes, both in the delivery and in the client side.
It's confidence and possibly a trust thing as well.
Yes, agreed. Surety and surety of that payment.
Ben, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I guess the engagement happens on a project by project basis. It can be relatively ad hoc. So it's that pipeline conversation. How do we make this conversation ubiquitous as part of our you know, sort of economic development growth sort of conversation? And I was at a meeting which concerned itself with the Swansea Bay City deal, and one of the perspectives that came from the floor was, do we know what's available in the area? So notwithstanding, okay, we haven't defined the project terms, we haven't defined necessarily the specs of these projects, but do we know from a first base guess the sorts of skills, the sorts of businesses that could deliver when those specs are identified? So again, it is about the intelligence as to what we have, it's the visibility of opportunities, whether they be public or private sector. I think the other thing that I hear is this notion of, again, whether it's public or private sector, there are closed shops. You know, there will be whether it's large scale developers or public agencies will have favourites, and that's the perception. Whether or not is the reality, I think, is another question. But the perception is that there are favourites. Now, I spoke to I won't name company names, but I spoke to an interiors company some time ago about talking about the redevelopment of here, Cardiff City Centre, and this individual said, "I could never bid in for this work, because the usual suspects are too close to those projects and will forever be given those opportunities." Now, if that's the perception, then we need to tackle that perception, because this business is in of itself, you know, a fast-growing business, a real opportunity there. But we have to tackle that perception that, you know, before the first instance, there are people shut out from that conversation. So that needs the engagement of larger organisations and public organisations with supply chain, you know, sort of along the way, to say we will prospect in the long term for all the talent that's available for us, rather than on a project by project basis, because otherwise necessarily that is rushed. Necessarily we don't get the ability to say, well, how do we develop the skills for that project which is likely to come along in 5 years, and then go to FEHE, wherever else it might be, and say, we need these skill sets to be brought through.
It's a far more strategic approach.
Yeah, I guess so.
I haven't really touched on risk and the transfer risk, and I say this because having sat in many supplier engagement events, they're very positive things. We hear the talk, and then when it actually comes down to the doing and the engage, you know, the real engagement, the tendering, if you like, we suddenly end up with something that's dumped all the risk somewhere, well, normally somewhere in the supply chain. So all the fine talk hasn't been translated into actually what is really going to happen. How do we tackle that? I'm looking at you, Terry, because again, I'm looking at the transport plan.
I wish I knew the answer to that, actually. I think there is a point at which we all have to stand up and say that I wouldn't bet my house on that, and that might be betting my business on that. Mm-hmm. So it is, obviously there has to be there are risks which one can bear and risks which one cannot. In transferring risk to a company which cannot bear it, you are actually going backwards, not forwards. So you have to take an intelligent make an intelligent assessment of what is reasonable for people to accept. Ultimately, if there was a major project and you wanted to transfer all the risk to me, I think that ultimately makes you the fool, because I cannot carry that risk. So of course there are means of dealing with it, not least of which is the various tendering forms, which are, you know, they're proactive and we manage risk between us. But the bottom line is, attempting to transfer risks to me which I cannot bear is a foolish thing to do. But nevertheless, the knee-jerk starting point, I think you are right, is, well, if I don't want it to be me, then it must be you.
It's a bit like musical chairs.
Yeah.
And whenever the music stops, you've ended up with a risk. And that's a culture change.
Yeah.
And we talked about trust, and you've got to trust one another to make sure that risk is actually apportioned to the right entity.
Absolutely.
I mentioned that because we started off some of the conversation with, do we really positively want to encourage Welsh companies to be involved in these things? But if we then subsequently just say, and by the way, all the risk is yours, they cannot bear it, so they will not be part of it. So I think it's something fundamental. I'll move on quickly just to the third bit, which is around upskilling. You know, we're moving into we are in a very different age. We're moving on with digitization, automation, perceived as threats, challenges, opportunities. How do we deal with this in terms of equipping our supply chains for the future? Do we just leave it to the supply chain, get on with it? Or do we take a more proactive role? What should I start with? Steve?
Okay, skills, something that's very close to my heart. I mean, we've got a great opportunity at the moment. So digitalization's coming through, and everybody's heard of BIM, Building Information Modelling. That's the panacea of all our woes. I think we've got to think a little bit more long-term than that, and look at things like sort of what do we need to develop a legacy that we're going to be proud of, you know, energy production, transportation, and we're going to have autonomous vehicles, and we're going to be able to use some of the tools such as BIM to be able to deliver these longer term visions. And we were talking this morning about the fact that we need that vision, and it's not just here are the tools, let things all just manifest themselves. It does need government leadership, it does need some ideas, so actually we can say Wales knows where it's going, it'll draw on other experiences from elsewhere in the globe, but we've got the ability to actually deliver our own vision, which we hopefully will be clear in our own minds. So, and then the upskilling agenda will follow that that visioning that's necessary.
Okay, Ben.
Yeah, and that notion of future-proofing is essential to allow us to keep ahead. I mentioned in the hall earlier, just being over to the Netherlands to look at their skill system. No one likes the people who say, I've just been somewhere and look at their model. However, what I would say that's very attractive about the system that I learned about there is that they have a body at the centre of the vocational skills conversation, which is a partnership between the providers, private sector and government. They, in collaboration, design the system. So business gets to inform and to help future-proof the agenda with the intelligence that it gets as to what it would need. But all the haggling is done in that entity, if you like. So I'm not saying that what is delivered out of the system is perfect, but nevertheless, it is probably better adept at responding to the skills demands of organisations. So I think one of my members said, the problem is that skills policy and skills are done to businesses, if that makes sense, rather than engineered by businesses in collaboration with the system. And I think that's probably where we need to go. And within Ken Skate's new economic development strategy, for whatever it looks like, that, I know the notion of the Welsh Government's cross-cutting strategy is that it binds these elements together, but it has to be seen as an economic imperative. Rather than sitting slightly outside economic development in another, hopefully not in the future, but in another silo. But I think that the need to bring businesses into the design, not just the deployment of skills, is really important.
Okay. Terry, just before I open it up to the floor, thoughts from you on skills and our supply chain?
I think we sell ourselves short in terms of the skills that we already possess. We are a very strong engineering-led country. Traditionally, we have been at the forefront of engineering, and a lot of the traditional skills will remain relevant throughout the course of the pipeline that we're talking about, so we shouldn't underplay that. In terms of the more technological aspects of things, I think there are always political arguments involving sort of league tables and the like, and it seems to me, in relation to that technological aspect of things, never mind about a league table, we're in danger of being relegated. What I don't see is the vision that says this is what the future looks like, that is where we are, and instead of talking about it, this is how we're actually going to get there. So for the more technological type of industries, I don't think it's a question even of upskilling. I don't even know what the plan is. Where is the plan? And I think that is for the public bodies, in conjunction with the trade associations like Ben's, to actually say to us, that's where we're going, and this is how we're going to get there. We're at the bottom of lots of league tables for education, that type of thing. Unless and until those things are put right, we will remain there. So where's the plan? What are those skills beyond those which we already possess, which we should not underplay? We should be ambitious going out into the world, selling the skills we already have before we worry too much about the other things, but we have to have a plan.
Yeah, and I think that was the what hit me from this morning's discussion, really, about that plan. Right, I'm going to open it up to the floor now. Liz, you've waited patiently. that question is still relevant now.
I've got two questions, actually.
Go on, you've waited a long time to answer.
I feel the public sector relies heavily on frameworks, and I'd like to know the panel's view of whether they see them as a positive or a negative. Personally, I see them as a negative, and I think they are restricting innovation, but I'd be welcome your views on that.
I'm happy to start on that, if you like. We at TFL, we use frameworks extensively. They were a closed shop. The barriers to entry to the framework effectively defined before we started what the outcome would be. So we have tried to change the procurement process to facilitate smaller niche type players who are able to enter our frameworks to provide a broader spectrum. Previously, the marking criteria were such that only a very small number of very large practices could gain access to them. So revising the scoring criteria, and frankly, taking a bit of a risk from time to time, is something that public bodies should be willing to do in the interests of the growth that we're all seeking.
Mm. Well, we benefit from frameworks, so I see positives if you're on it, and negatives if you're not on it. I can see the benefits in as far as you set up long-term relationships and you start to get into a flow of work and you start to see pipelines as well. So there is a benefit from somebody.
They're only 4 years, aren't they?
Mm. They tend to be four, they can be a little bit shorter. One point I would like to make, though, is often it's, and we're very amenable to the fact that we would like to bring in a lot more support in our supply chains. But if they're not in the original framework submission, it's quite difficult to actually get their approval. and you think you really want it quite easy. You know, you don't want to go through a machination of having that extra person that you didn't realise you needed brought into the framework, because it actually might add benefit. And that would open up, and the problem is only the bigger boys tend to get on the frameworks.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the way it is. But if the bigger boys had the ability to bring in the supply chain, it would open a route to market via a back door, by a different route. And I think you as a client could help in that facet.
Do you want to, not necessarily from an infrastructure perspective, but just from a general business perspective in frameworks?
Yeah, I guess, Terry sort of gave exactly the sort of perspective I'd give. I think it is about the flexibility of frameworks and the scoring that's applied to frameworks. However, I think I'm pragmatic enough to realise that there's a reason that frameworks exist. There is an accountability for particularly public spend that has to be there within the system. You can do that without frameworks, but again, what that does is, you know, to go back to that conversation about risk, that helps mitigate the risk, and that's the problem. It's the licensing of the risk. So with the licensing of the risk, arguably you wouldn't need the frameworks to, you know, to sort of cover that risk. I think it is about the flexibility of the framework and the scoring that's applied to it, and going back to that notion of this should be a development process for businesses. So we have to design a system that is there to grow businesses, not just to grow businesses in size, but to grow businesses in competence and help them get to that next step of bidding.
I think that's coming through quite a bit today, is whether or not public sector see that as part of their role to help develop businesses.
Well, the next question I've got is, in terms of engaging with the supply chain, we've done an awful lot of work on subcontracting, because the biggest query I get is you give the contract to this supplier and then they flow all the work down the supply chain, down and down and down, subcontracting. People at the bottom, like Stephen have already said, don't get paid for 120 days. We've done an awful lot of work in Caerphilly to reduce that and only allow subcontracting two tiers, flow down of terms and conditions. As part of our contract management, we find that the first tier supplier never flows down the terms. We did big negotiations with them. We've got to keep pulling them in and holding them to the terms and conditions of contract, even threaten them, you know, with termination because they're not flowing them down. So what do you do as suppliers to give me confidence that you want to work with the supply chain yourself and you want to be fair to them? Because I think we get criticised such a lot in the public sector for not looking after the small boys, but I think some of the contractors themselves got a job to do as well.
I'll leave that to the suppliers.
I hear
absolutely.
In some regards, yeah, we do have a long way to go, and I think I also think sometimes when the terms and conditions are passed straight down, that's inequitable as well, because they're not designed for the smaller practices either.
So only certain ones, you talked about payment terms yourself.
Yeah.
If I pay you in 10 days, why don't you pay your supply chain in 10 days?
Yeah, exactly.
And why don't you give them similar terms and conditions in terms of, you know, zero contracts and whatever? We are asked to move away from all of that, but the minute we actually let a contract, and, you know, we are being criticised as public sector procurement officers, but the actual supply chain themselves got a responsibility.
And I think that's a conversation you'd have to have with your suppliers. And obviously you're bringing them in and threatening them with termination.
Be turning in his grave.
Can I just say, because
what I'm saying is we find it takes a lot of actually contract management, because a lot of the companies are telling us we want to look after SMEs and all the rest of it. They don't, because they don't flow those terms down, and it takes us a lot of work to keep contract managing them to make sure it flows down. And I had a small SME sat in my office last week saying to me, Liz, you've put all of this in place, but they're still not paying me. We need you to help us unlock this. So what I'm saying, it's all very well to sit there and say public sector procurement officers don't do this, that and the other.
But it's also down to the trade associations that many of those organisations are members of.
Yeah.
And in the case of larger businesses, CBI, in the case of smaller businesses, maybe ourselves, to exert that expectation. Now, you know, clearly within retail, within supermarkets, there's, you know, sort of earlier this year, there was not, I think it actually came from the Labour Party, sort of a naming and shaming. And we've undertaken our own work that looks at kind of the worst elements of that. But I think there has to be an expectation that is heaped on all businesses by their trade associations as to what good, you know, that they do have a responsibility within the supply chain. You're absolutely right. It isn't just about dumping it at the door of the public sector and say, what can you do about this? It's about competitive challenge internally.
Mm. But this comes back to long-term relationships and the trust, isn't it? If you know there's a contractor that does that, he looks after his SMEs, hopefully could really look at them more favourably than somebody who's been giving them another set in a hard time. And it's a whole dynamic of making sure that you're aware of it, making sure they're aware of it. If they act and perform correctly, then they're more likely to get more work from you.
It sounds to me carrot and stick.
Yeah.
So the carrot is the long-term relationship. The stick is you have agreed to do something. You are now flouting that which you have agreed. The stick, whether it's within your contracts or within your broader business in terms of whether someone becomes part of a long-term relationship or not, I think you are the you can author your own future in that regard. I would only say it's a little bit more complicated than perhaps comes across from the question, because of course if you pay me in 10 days and then I have to pay you in 10 days, there's a point at which I am out of pocket. So there's always a flow down. I think that's common. There's also the issue in terms of if you only allow second tier contracting, then lots of Ben's members who may be the smaller painter, plumber, whatever, they are excluded because they're not large enough to be within the second tier.
Mm.
So
not necessarily, it depends on the value. But we've tried our best, because we've listened to the SMEs, to give them an opportunity to work with organisations like ourselves via the larger companies. But we've caught a cold on some of it by trying it. Mm. Because the bigger companies haven't played ball.
Mm.
And that's stick and carrot.
Yeah, I think this is probably a conversation we'll continue between ourselves. Derek, you wanted to make a point. I don't know if you had
like you know, pay when paid. And I mean, Denning, in his judgment, outlawed that 30 odd years ago, only for the House of Lords to overturn it. It wasn't a problem. You know, I do have contracts where we would pay the subcontractor when we were paid. But as soon as Denning had made that judgment, it's out of the window.
Yeah.
I think making, you know, mountains out of molehills, right?
I think there are mechanisms that you know, we are looking at now, but there's a cultural issue here as well. I don't know if you've got a comment to make quickly, but another lady there wanted to...
Just in terms of contracts and payment, obviously the Construction Act sets out date for payment, final date for payment, etc. And if you draft the subcontracts to be a part of the main contract, you've got control over what goes in the subcontracts as to when they get paid.
Yeah, I know all of that, but what I'm saying in real life,
it's just not happening.
I think there is a cultural issue here, isn't there, which is incumbent on us all.
And I sit here sometimes and you're, public sector's got to do more for the supply chain. But I think it's about the supply chain got to do more as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not all one-sided.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We're going to take a final question now.
Kind of gender leads on from there, but I'll keep it kind of general. I look at marine energy in Wales, so kind of coming from the infrastructure from a slightly different side, not looking at the lagoons, looking at the smaller technology developers. But what's striking me as interesting is in Anglesey, there's been demands for Welsh language adherence from Horizon, Welsh language adherence, and community supply chain sort of upskilling. And what Horizon have done, it's one of my favourite stories, is they've actually upskilled local builders to build bat barns, because bats are protected species and they have to be moved. Now, this was obviously a demand from the community as a whole, not just procurement officers banging on the door. Everyone was saying, if you want to come into our community, we expect these things of you. What role do you think that would have in forcing maybe, you know, the Motts and the Arabs and the larger firms to actually engage more wholly then with local suppliers and building these long-term relationships. Because if you teach someone in school how to do something, you haven't got your average of a fabricator being 64 in Wales. I was told that the other day, I was astonished. You know, a high-scale fabricator, the average age is 64.
Mm.
But I think what's driven that is the client, isn't it? You in Horizon have said this is how it will be, and maybe that's part of the lesson here. Some quick comments.
Yeah, I mean, Mott's would so, as long as we were aware that was going on, then it would make an eminent sense to engage with the local community and get those bat boxes constructed locally and see the benefit of their work.
Does that get asked of you?
It would do through Horizon, yeah. I mean, that's a great story.
Pretty good, but
we don't hear enough of it.
Okay.
And I think, you know, you'll do your environmental audits, you'll identify where the bats are, but nobody's then going to the next level saying, well, who's going to build the bat boxes? It's sort of left to the market to decide, and what Horizon have done is very interesting.
And is there a project manager there, actually?
Yeah, so somebody's gone and put two and two together and said, oh, well, we need local people working, why don't they do that?
Yeah.
Which is great.
Just on that point, I mean, a project like that, you know, what you want to do, and for any large-scale infrastructure project, what you want to do if you're an organisational lead is to make yourself part of that community, and it's the way in which you engage with, whether it be with education or whether it be with the local supply chain, smaller businesses not in the supply chain, you want to make yourself part of the community because that becomes then a more constructive relationship and has a social good as well.
Yeah.
Final commentary?
I think not in relation specifically to that, but my position essentially is that collectively, whether you are the private individual, whether you are the small, the medium, the large, whether you're the public body, the time is now for Wales to be ambitious, have a plan and implement it. And if I was sat that side rather than this side, the thing I would have said is, didn't I come here 20 years ago and talk about all the same things? So, and I'm sure the answer would have been yes, if it wasn't even longer ago than that. Where I am with all of this is, whatever we do, let's just do it. Let's just get on with it.
Well, we've got an example down here in the bay. I mean, where you know, the contractors are required to use local employees to train local kids. What's happened to that? When was that? Was back in 1980 odd?
Yeah,
you've got a great example already down here.
I think we could probably open a whole other topic here on social value, but you're absolutely right, and I think there is a question for us all to ask. How much do we want to squeeze out of this investment? And there are ways that we can squeeze a lot more out of it if we work in a far more strategic and coordinated way. Just quickly, just to round off some of the points I've picked up on, and I should have said this is all being recorded, so you're on there, okay? So we will know who you are.
It's too late.
I think there's some questions here. Do we want to support and grow our indigenous companies through this process, through this investment? Do we take a more strategic approach where clients are far more involved in this, not just transactionally passing things through the supply chain risk, etc. And the skills, you know, what is the plan? Work it up. What do we want to develop for the future? And use, again, this investment to develop that. And frameworks, I'm not going to go there just yet, but I think there is a conversation to be had. They need to be managed. Like this whole relationship, I think we need to move from transactional to collaborative far quicker than we are.
Mm.
On that note, I'm going to close. I think it's probably cup of tea time. Thanks very much for your participation. Could you just show your appreciation to the panel as well, please? Thank you very much. Diolch yn fawr. Tea time.